Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my next interview is with Brian McLaren, and I was absolutely thrilled to get him back onto Face to Face. He was a guest here a couple of years ago, and Brian and I have been having kind of a conversation, I think, for a few years, on and off, about a variety of different things. But today, we talk about specifically about his relatively new book called The Great Spiritual Migration. It is well worth the read. So many launching points and questions and things to work through about Christianity, about religion, about faith. The subtitle of the book is How the World's Largest Religion is Seeking a Better Way to Be Christian. And if anyone is rooted or is willing to be honest about this conversation, rooted in the conversation, I was going to say, they are going to want to crack the cover of this book. We talk about grace and generosity. We talk about how religions have to get away from being organized to become organizing. We have to talk about differences as assets and not liabilities, says Brian. We talk about the way of love and about how people are kind of leaving religion, and how religion, and how specifically for Brian, Christianity is about a process. It's about relationship. It's about the problem of being human and coming to terms with that and addressing that in a way that allows us to let our story individually, but also the greater story of humanity and of love and so on, serving us well. So make sure you dial in. This is a great interview. I had a blast. And once again, it's one of those conversations where you kind of wish they wouldn't end. And I think that's the beautiful thing about this and about what Brian is doing with his work and shining the light on humanity and hope and humility in a way that helps to frame a new story for all of us, I think is really quite remarkable. There's something here for everybody. This isn't a book just for Christians. This is a book for people who are interested in where we're heading. I think people who are interested in meaning and so many other things. So stay tuned. Brian McLaren coming right up. Don't forget davidpecklive.com for more information about my writing and speaking and so on. And also face2facelive.ca for a whole host of other interviews about writers and filmmakers and having conversations about things that matter. Coming right up, The Great Spiritual Migration with Brian McLaren. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest here with us today, a returning guest, I believe, from several years ago. Brian McLaren is here with us today to talk about his, I guess, relatively new book, The Great Spiritual Migration, subtitled How the World's Largest Religion is Seeking a Better Way to Be Christian. Brian, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you again.
So I guess it is a couple of years, isn't it?
Great Spiritual Migration came out in 2016 in hardcover and then 2017 in softcover. So, yeah, but I haven't written anything since. I feel like there's still plenty to talk about with that book. So that's my current book.
So I've done the book, and thank you for the book, and congratulations on the book. And I think I've said to you before, it's a remarkable read. It's one of my more underlined books of late, and yet as I was flipping through it as I was prepping for the interview, I kind of didn't know where to start almost with some of my questions. But you know, the title, The Great Spiritual Migration, I mean, aren't people just leaving, period?
Yeah,
I mean, religion, period. I mean, maybe we don't even need to talk about being a better way to be Christian at this point, but aren't people leaving in droves? Like, didn't Lenny Bruce years ago say, everyday people are leaving religion and going back to God, I think was the quote from back in the 60s.
Yeah, well, it's complicated, as you know.
Yeah.
It used to be that Christianity was the world's largest religion with about 33% of the world's population. Islam was second largest with 21 to 24%, and Hinduism was next to 17%. But non-religious, unreligiously affiliated people now have surpassed Hindus. So they're somewhere in the 17+% range. And so this is a global phenomenon. People are leaving active practice of Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam. But here in North America, we're seeing patterns that are remarkably similar to European patterns, maybe 50 to 100 years later. But yes, similar patterns of being religiously unaffiliated.
And is that, I don't get the sense that that's a huge problem for you.
Well, David, as you know, I've gone through a very, very deep and ongoing rethinking process.
Right, which is what I so love about this book, by the way. That sense of, I don't know, like you say, ongoing, but it's a process, it's a relationship.
Yeah.
It's kind of happening as we speak.
And you know, as a guy living south of the border, watching what's happened to both conservative Protestantism and conservative Catholicism in this country, where white Christians of all persuasions have been happy to sign up to line up behind an obvious authoritarian demagogue who courts white supremacists, neo-Nazis, anti-Semites, Islamophobes, homophobes, and all the rest. And watching white Christianity in many ways sell its soul in this way, sometimes I think that, people worry about Christianity dying. I, as I say in the book, I'm much more worried about Christianity killing. And I would be much more concerned about large numbers of people affiliating with the forms of the Christian religion that I think, if you don't mind me being a little dramatic and borrowing a phrase from Jesus, that turn people into twice the sons of hell they were before. So I am a deep believer in Jesus and the way of Christ. And in the long run, I'm a deep believer in organized religion and in the Christian faith. But we're in a rough patch right now, and people have a good reason to leave. But that is also why there are other people who are saying the status quo is increasingly untenable, and so new ways of being Christian are becoming more and more possible. And I don't think anything's guaranteed, but I think depending on how people like us and everyone listening, depending on how we live, the future could be much better than the past and the present.
There's a sense in which you just kind of go, I just need to wash my hands, I think, or at least there is for me. I mean, it just wow. You know, you look at the stats, you look at the history, you look at what's going on, and what, like as you say, what people are aligning themselves with, and around the world. Frankly, we can have some fun, you know, blaming the U.S. for everything. You don't mind that, do you, Brian?
If the shoe fits.
That's right. But there's a sense where you just go, why bother? Like, I'm done. I'm moving on.
And that is totally understandable. And when I have many of my friends say that that's kind of the path they're taking, I just tell them, I'm your friend. We can talk about anything. And let's, don't worry about being rejected by me. But here's the interesting thing. Let's say that you decide to disaffiliate with the Christian faith. It's not like there's another great religious option that doesn't have its own skeletons in the closet, right?
Right.
Any religion with any history, here's two ways to say it, David. Any religion with any history has, skeletons in its closet. And any new religion, its worst days are still ahead of it.
That's hilarious. Yeah.
And then you realize this isn't just a problem of Christianity or
right.
of religion. It's a problem of human being.
Right, right.
Whether it's we could talk about political ideology, economic ideologies, nationalism, any way that, corporations, Facebook, in the news these days, any organization that people affiliate with, we human beings have ways to, make it ugly. And these are flaws and immaturities and blindnesses that are still baked into us. And so ironically, if we want to talk about fixing those things in any part of human life, then we're talking about the development of character and the development of values and the development of a narrative and the development of habits and practices and communities of practice. And suddenly it sounds like we're talking about religion again, in some way.
Do you think, is this about oppression? Is this about power? I mean, you talked about being, immature, I think, as a human. And, and then for me, that sort of raises the question, how did we become so immature, I suppose? Or maybe we always were, fascinated by all the wrong things, hypnotized by power and prestige, I suppose. The problem being human, is there a root to that?
If you want to take the big evolutionary time frame, and you think, our species, scientists just say, really, us as a gene pool, we've only been around for 200,000 years, and how much of that we've had anything like a sophisticated language, I couldn't guess. We've only had agriculture for 12,000 years. You realize we're still very, very new.
Mm. Yeah.
We're not that far climbing down from the trees, So we're very new. And we've evolved so quickly. And our capacity to build weapons always seems to outstrip our character and wisdom in knowing how to use them. I think, in part, this is an evolutionary problem. One particular dimension of it, though, is our capacity for aggression and violence.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really interesting is, as a species, I think, we evolved a phenomenally effective method of dealing with chaotic violence tens of thousands of years ago. But over time, we started to see that method of solving one set of problems created a new set of problems. And what I'm referring to is patriarchy.
Mm.
And I really think part of the moment that we're in now as a species is we're nudging up against the ability to outgrow patriarchy and move to a better way of being human individually and as societies. And this is one of the reasons both religion and government are having such a struggle right now. We're having a reversion to patriarchy in government.
Mm.
Around the world, there's this return to strongman leaders, whether it's Trump in the U.S. or, in Philippines or Italy or several Eastern European countries. This appeal of the strongman, Putin in Russia. I think this is our opportunity to mature into a new level of interaction, but we're struggling with it. And our religious communities are really the communities that in the past have helped people develop the habits of the heart and the habits of society to keep moving forward. But right now, they're lagging behind.
You know, it's so funny that the very thing that brings us together seems, you know, being human can you find more common ground than that? So being human, and yet that's the very thing that seems to be driving us apart and creating that division. This, you know, you talk a great deal about, I think, difference as being an asset.
Yeah.
And not a liability, right? Similarity through difference, right?
Yeah.
And yet, boy, does that seem like a pretty difficult thing for us to land on. Do you know the Canadian novelist Richard Wagamese?
No, I don't.
So he passed away about a year ago, and he's written many First Nations perspective, obviously many different novels, but he talks about stories having the capacity to heal. And you also get into that a little bit, and maybe you can sort of connect that back to the whole differences, assets, and not liabilities. But this idea you bring up in the book, Brian, that narrative precedes system. And
yeah.
I'd love, you don't have to connect those two, but I sort of sense that they're connected,
yeah.
but not necessarily. Anyway, Richard's work is well worth looking into. That is for sure. If you get a chance, his new film's being released in Canada very soon. Stephen Campanelli's turned it into a film, Indian Horse. Anyway, look for it if you get a chance.
Well, yeah, you've got me intrigued because I couldn't agree more. I think we frame our individual lives by certain stories. Growing up, I was the quiet, smart kid. I liked to just sort of. I had a story about myself that I told. My family had a story. My denomination had a story. The Christian religion had a story. My nation had a story that it told itself. And sometimes our stories serve us really well. They're more or less accurate. Sometimes they're full of delusion and deceit, and they serve us very, very badly. So, and they hurt other people. So this issue of how narratives frame us is extremely interesting to me. It became really interesting to me some years ago when I'd been a pastor for enough years that I really, was deeply familiar with the Bible. And I started to realize that in many ways, Jesus showed up on the scene trying to tell a different story. He was trying to give people an alternative story to live by. And he had the Pharisees and telling one story, and the Zealots telling another story, and the Herodians and Sadducees telling another story, and the Essenes telling another. There are all these conflicting stories about what life is about, what's going on here, how we should live, what we're hoping for. They give us a vision of the past, the present, and the future. And Jesus came along with this different story. And that's very much where I think we are, where we're stuck right now. I just use Trump as an example, even though in one sense all of us are sick of hearing his name, in another sense, he's an intrusion into almost every dimension of life right now. But when he had this America First story, it's the story of nationalism and the idea that our future comes from putting our nation first. And in a sense, being happy for us to win and others to lose. That's an old story, and many of us, I think actually, it's one of the stories that the Bible critiques quite strongly, but it's got its appeal. And he told that story and people bought it.
Do you think that the story of, I guess we could talk about the story of religion, but you're more specifically talking about the story of Christianity or a new story of Christianity. Do you think folks today that are having problems with that narrative, the current narrative or what we hear most about, I suppose, is actually, going to disallow them from seeing things in a new way. And, you know, that, you know, you talk a lot about paradigms in the book, and yes. I would say throughout your writing, for, you know, over the years, yeah. you've spoken a great deal about paradigmatic shifts in a variety of ways. So, yeah. I mean, and I'm not really concerned about convincing people to come over to this side in any way, shape, or form in our conversation, but the story is going to get in the way, the current story is going to get in the way of a new story. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, you might say when a current story or paradigm or, you know, system of thought, or my favorite term for it is a framing story. It's mm-hmm. the story that we frame everything in. When a framing story is working really well, it's almost impossible. In fact, psychologists call it confirmation bias. Anything that doesn't fit in with that story just bounces off.
Right.
It can't even get through. So, yeah, stories have a certain stories that are working have a certain filtering capacity. And I think it's why Jesus had to constantly speak of blindness. Hmm. You just can't see things when you're deep in a story that seems to be working for you. But sometimes the story stops working for you. And other times you realize that the story that's working for you is hurting other people. And one way or another, when it starts to crumble, that's when you start looking for a better story. And a whole lot of the people who are leaving religion have just realized there's no story there for me that makes any sense. Now, there might be, you know, some theologian in some, you know, mountaintop monastery somewhere might have a story that could help people within their religion, but they've never heard it. And the popular versions that they've heard make no sense to them. But what's happening in the Christian faith, and I'm privileged to have Muslim and Jewish and Hindu and other friends who tell me they have similar things going on in their tradition. But what's happening in the Christian faith is there is a radical re-examination and reconstruction of a kind of Christian story, and that's what I'm talking about in The Great Spiritual Migration.
You talk about Christians, I think, and maybe, you know what, maybe we should, you know, we're like, you know, almost 20 minutes in and we haven't really defined what a Christian is, or you haven't defined what a Christian is for us. That might not be a bad place to sort of go now, but you talk about, I think, in the book, Christians as being, and maybe all of us, frankly, as people in motion, or maybe you speak about it sort of prescriptively in the sense that we should be, you know, people of motion.
Yeah, yeah. So here's, you know, I think there are two ways I would define Christian. One is a Christian is an adherent to the Christian religion. So mm-hmm. if you call yourself a Christian, in one sense, I'll say, okay, you're a Christian, right? If I were looking for a deeper sense, I would probably talk about people who are actually dedicated to following Christ. Like, I don't care that much about what they say they believe or what organization or institution they're affiliated with. I know other people care about that a great deal. I just don't care about it that much. In fact, the first third of The Great Spiritual Migration, I make a proposal that for some people is so obvious and so easy to accept, and other people is appalling and incomprehensible. And the proposal is this, that we stop defining Christianity as a system of beliefs, and rather we define it as a way of life. Part of that way of life is thinking about our beliefs. So I'm not against beliefs. I think beliefs are great. They're just not the point. And this is happening in many, many sectors of the Christian faith. This, in a sense, this unbolting of the system of beliefs, this endless argumentation about who has the perfect set of beliefs. And instead, people are saying, you know, that doesn't seem to be getting us where we need to go. What is the way of life that Jesus embodied and taught? If I want to be a Christian, I probably ought to take that seriously. So that, for me, is a starting point.
So it's more about, I guess, another word, and again, I'm pretty sure you speak about it a great deal in the book, is movement, or a movement.
Exactly right, because if you're about a system of beliefs, then once you have it right, your job is to stay put. Don't change. Hold the line. But if you say, you know, that's not really the point. We're here to if this way of life is a way of love, and if love directs us outward, we have to love ourselves, but we, the same love that we have for ourselves, we learn to extend to our neighbor. Oh, and not just to our neighbor, but also to the stranger and the alien. Oh, and not just to the stranger and the alien, but also the outcast and the outsider. And not just the outcast and outsider, but even to the enemy, right? So now we have this radical expansion of the circle of love. And then that circle of love, if we love human beings, we have to love the earth, because there are no human beings without the earth. And so, you know, this old idea that you could love souls and care about souls but not care about bodies, and bodies need to breathe, so there has to be an atmosphere and a climate, and bodies need to drink, so there has to be clean water, and bodies need to eat, so there has to be soil and all the rest. Suddenly now we're loving all of creation, right? And my personal belief is that part of Jesus' message, and really part of the message that begins in the prophets and extends all the way through the New Testament, is that there is no way to meaningfully speak of loving God without also speaking of loving, without also loving your fellow creatures. So, right. So that becomes a movement, because love gets you moving, and it's this constant movement out of ourselves to the other. And this is one of the other big challenges of not just the Christian religion, but all of our major world religions, that they do become institutionalized, and there's nothing wrong with that. Institutions are important, but institutions rely on vital movements, and movements are always interacting with institutions. And part of what's happened in the Christian faith is we have really become we've become complacent in our institutions, and we need to become reactivated in our movements.
Is this a little bit what you mean about from organized to organizing?
Exactly. So the way I like to say it is that organized religion is religion organized for self-preservation. And it, that's what ends up happening with our institutions. They exist to preserve. And sadly, because we're the inheritors of patriarchy, what that ends up meaning is that, and it, this doesn't have to be this way, I'm just saying I think it is,
right,
that institutions exist to protect the powerful men, primarily men, who run them. And frankly, it, in Western context, it's the powerful, privileged white men who run them. And to keep them happy, to fulfill their tastes, to you know, conform to their preferences. But if part of what happens now is we say, well, hold it, we're not just an institution, we're a movement, and we have to challenge institutions with a call to keep moving forward in the areas of justice and in the areas of peace and in the areas of caring for the planet and working for the poor. Well, now organized religion has to stop being organized for its own self-preservation and the protection of its elites, and it has to become, it has to organize for the common good. And this is why we need organization, we need institutions, but we need them to be leveraged to help us be engaged working for the common good.
It's, you know, it reminds me a little bit, the analog, I think, or at least partial analog, I suppose, is, you know, not large nonprofit organizations who want to talk about, you know, authenticity and being, you know, nimble.
Yes.
And they're these massive organizations, and they become, well, they're principalities in a sense, but they exist sort of for others, and they're here to solve the problems of the world, and it's about social justice, and for faith-based organizations, it's about loving their neighbors. But how much of that is really become about serving, you know, the institution itself? And it's heartbreaking. When you see that, and when people are more interested in protecting their own pensions over protecting the poor, you know?
Yeah. So two quick thoughts on that, David. I couldn't agree with you more. A friend of mine says the first thing to go in an institution is the mission.
Wow.
And I experienced that. I'm sure you have big box hardware stores and lumber stores. And
that's
stores. And so I had to go to one of these. This is several years ago now, but I needed this special kind of light bulb, and I knew I had seen it at this store before. But I went, and I couldn't find it anywhere. And there's like 9 employees in a little circle in the aisleways, and they're talking about some office gossip or company gossip.
Yeah, 20 years ago, they would have all been smoking cigarettes, right? You know that, right?
Right. And I'm literally circling around them trying to break in, and I sort of want to jump up and down and say, hey, you guys, the reason you're here is for me, you know. If I can't find my light bulb, you know. But obviously, that little ingrown circle happens. And so a hospital exists to make doctors rich. And a school can exist to protect teachers from having to work too hard. And, it just goes on and on. But how important are schools to actually keep their mission going? And how important are hospitals to keep their mission going? So when people see malfunctioning institutions, they get angry and they want to get rid of the institutions. No, we need them desperately. If you lose your institutions, you're Libya. You know, if you lose your institutions, Syria. We need institutions. We have no idea how chaotic and how far we've come. I mean, we depend on hundreds and hundreds of institutions to be doing their work in an interlocking kind of way. But this is where faith communities come in, I think, because if faith is about imagining what's possible, it's not actual, what's not easy, but what is possible, then in a sense, it's faith that makes us challenge our institutions to keep growing and improving and doing better.
Does that make sense? It does make sense. Yeah, I love the notion about faith being about asking about, you know, what's possible, reaching out sort of beyond our grasp in a sense. And isn't that what, you know, I don't know, love and taking risks and being authentic is kind of really all about. Do you mind if we change gears a little bit? And this is partially because I've just finished reading Indian Horse and actually watching the film as well, and going to be interviewing. I'm kind of thrilled about it. Stephen Campanelli, he's the camera. He's been the camera operator, the Steadicam operator for Clint Eastwood for over 25 years. And
wow.
So anyway, his I think his second or third film now, Indian Horse, this Richard Wagamese piece about First Nations communities here and the residential school system. And you say you have a whole chapter, the genocide card in your back pocket. And there's a quote here. I'm just going to give a little bit of page 75 from The Great Spiritual Migration. Quote, the only way Christianity can become salvageable is by admitting that it is unsalvageable in its present form. The only way it can be saved is to admit that it is lost. The only way it can be healed is to admit that it is blind, deaf, lame, and sick, close quote. Pretty strong words for a strongly titled chapter, the genocide card in your back pocket. I think this is one of those issues after watching Indian Horse, after reading the book, I kind of go, we have no idea. We have no idea what happened.
Yeah. And in fact, that chapter was inspired in many ways by a Canadian First Nations scholar named Ozzie Talon. And I was actually drawing from a quote from her about Christianity being unsalvageable. And she says, from the perspective of a First Nations person who was on the receiving end of the worst of Christianity.
Right.
And then adding to that, the damage that a kind of plundering, triumphalistic, industrial strength Christianity has done to the earth. You know, she says, the earth cannot sustain another 500 years of Christian domination. And I think she's right. And it's one of the reasons why I'm such an advocate for change in the Christian faith. Obviously, I think the way that we have behaved has been grossly unfaithful to Christ, to our founder, who I love and follow. But I also just think, out of love for our neighbors, we better make sure that the Christian faith, you know, gets turned around.
How did, Brian, how did anybody ever think that, that the doctrine of discovery was a good idea?
Yeah, you know, I'll
tell you. Or any of that, you know, the residential school system. I mean, you almost watch it represented in film, you read about it, you start to unpack it in conversation with somebody, and you just go, this didn't really happen, did it?
Yeah, I know.
It's just the inhumanity of it, the cruelty.
It is stunning. And it's one of the things, as we said earlier, if you are living in a story, you know, all of these psychological factors like confirmation bias, another one, I call it competency bias in education. It's called the Dunning-Kruger hypothesis, and it basically says that incompetent people are incompetent of knowing how incompetent they are.
Right.
You know, they don't know enough to know how little they know. You put all that together, and people can do horrible, horrible things. And so, this is in no way making an excuse, but for us trying to understand, I can imagine, you know, our great-great-great-grandchildren a couple centuries from now, if they could come back in a time machine and they see the devastation that fossil fuels have done to the earth, I can imagine them putting you and me on trial and saying, you guys owned cars. You guys heated your home with electricity that came from oil or coal. You guys flew on airplanes. You're monsters. You know what I mean?
I
can easily see them saying that. And our only defense would be, that's how everybody traveled. That's how everybody thought. It doesn't excuse us at all. But then you look back at what was done by people who were as oblivious to their damage as many of us have been about fossil fuels. And you just think, oh, God help us, you know. Mm-hmm. It's horrible. And you know, I think I was in my 50s before I ever even heard of the doctrine of discovery. And that's another part of this problem. In the Christian community, as in many communities, we keep secrets. And the story we tell ourselves is a sanitized story. And that's very, very dangerous.
It's and I think you're right. I mean, it's I've been doing for the last couple of years, and I've mentioned it in a few interviews, probably in the last couple of years, with the one class I teach still at Humber College in International Development. I've been bringing in a First Nations leader who lives in Toronto, doing a blanket ceremony. I don't know if you've ever been through one of those, but it's quite a remarkable way of telling the story and all of that. That horrible part of our history kind of comes out in about a 60 to 90 minute exercise. There's about 60 students, you know, blankets are put down to represent the provinces of Canada. Students stand on them. And then one by one, the doctrines are read and the proclamations are made and people walk around and touch you and they say, hey, you just died of scurvy and you just got moved into a residential school. And it's really this, talk about being immersed in this narrative kind of, a class, I guess you could say, or experience. And then at the end of it, I've been in tears over it. I've watched students just kind of coming to terms with it because it just roots you in a way. Wow, I've never even, you know, I like it when you said I haven't heard of the doctrine of discovery till you were in your 50s. I guess in the last eight to 10 years sort of started getting a better understanding of just how deep, all of this, the darkness goes.
Yes,
and it's just. Do you think? I mean, do you think? I'm pretty sure I know what you think on this, but I'd love to hear more about it. Do we kind of need to repent? I guess in a sense, and say, I mean, it kind of, because on one hand, that sort of is a contradiction, probably, of the Christian message, but at the same time, guys, boy, did we blow it? That's not even scratching the surface.
Yeah, I think this is very, very humbling. It's very, very humbling. You know, years ago, I can't remember the psychologist, but some psychologist wrote something like this: happy are those who have ruined their lives.
Mm.
And I think what he meant was when you know you've ruined your life, you lose a certain naivete and you become humble in a certain way. And you, for the rest of your life, you live better because you know that you've ruined your life at least once, you know. And I think there is something like this for nations and for religions. I think, and civilization, for the rest of human history, Western civilization, with its Christian roots and its roots in colonialism, is going to have to acknowledge the horrors that it did through colonialism and the doctrine of discovery and so on. It will be part of the story we tell about ourselves forever. Hopefully the way we do about the Holocaust. We, in Western civilization, have to look back in the 20th century and say, do you understand what advanced scientific people used their scientific knowledge and organizational bureaucratic knowledge to do to exterminate 6 million people? It becomes a humbling part of our history. And frankly, all of human civilization for the future, if we get through this next rough patch, we'll have to tell the story of our destruction of the planet. You know, I was just watching a video the other night about a section of China where that's a wasteland. Mm. And they just discovered that it used to be a verdant countryside. Mm-hmm. But hundreds and hundreds of years ago, people started grazing animals on it. And so what, you know, for 500 years, people have thought of it as a wasteland. It was a wasteland because of overgrazing,
right?
You know, 800 years ago. And you just realize this isn't, we've been making these ecological mistakes for a long, long time. And this, if we can own this and be humbled by it, it becomes part of the story we tell ourselves about our past. I think it will help us be wiser as we move into the future.
That's good. Sadly, we're going to have to wrap this up in a few minutes, Brian. Clearly, we're gonna have to do a part two. We barely scratched the surface. What do you say to the critics, the hypercritics, who say, now, okay, love what you're saying, sounds great, but let's you know, the next step in evolution should be that we're just going to eradicate religion altogether. And
yeah.
is that a better world? I mean, I don't. Yeah. Anyway, I think you've kind of, in a sense, implicitly already answered the question. But I'd love to hear, because you do wind up very hopeful at the end of the Great Spiritual Migration. I mean, clearly the thread runs throughout. But you come to, you know, the chapter about so much being right with the world.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the thing I would say to a person who says that is, at first, I'd ask them what they mean by religion, because maybe when they're defining religion, I would agree with them. What they're defining,
right,
you know, maybe needs to go. But I would say to them, listen, the world that we desire and dream of is based on a set of values. Who is going to teach those values? And it's not just values that you hold in theory. It's also capacities. You might call them moral skills or character qualities. And who's going to teach those character qualities and that kind of moral know-how to future generations? And who's going to stand for it in the public square? And who's going to, in a sense, justify that set of values when it is attacked or when they're eroded or when corruption is overcoming them? You know, suddenly you realize if we're talking about moral values, we're talking about a vision of the future, we're talking about quality of character and so on. You can call it whatever you want. You can call it Fred. You can call it, you know, mm-hmm. whatever. But that's religion. You know,
right.
That's the quest for meaning. That's the question. That's the quest for a story to live by. That's the quest for what the great Catholic philosopher and writer John Haught calls, it's the quest for rightness.
Mm.
What's the right way to live? People are always going to be asking that question.
Let's end on love. Near the end of the book, you say it's difficult to make love for neighbor, self, the earth, and God your life's highest ambition. It's difficult to cancel your nostalgic vacation into the past or awaken from your fanciful speculations about the future so you can engage passionately with the fierce urgency of now. You then go on to talk about this way of love, this sort of global, I guess, spiritual movement of love. But you also talk about it being, you know, annoying and frustrating and disappointing and all those things. So you're sort of like, wow, this is wonderful. And isn't this uplifting and hopeful? And yet, this is not going to be easy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I'm sitting in my house right now. And if I look out my back window, I see the lights of my neighbor, who is a Trump supporting, Islamophobic, white supremacist, angry man, you know, and I have to learn how to love him. And I have to accept him, try to understand him, appreciate him as my neighbor, and at the same time hope that I might be able to nudge him just a little bit more toward the way of love himself, you know. And even if he doesn't, I might have to get in the way and try to protect some people who he might hurt, you know.
Right.
But that's reality. And so it's not easy. And of course, all of us who've been parents, we know our kids go through some rough patches. I just heard a song by a great songwriter named Andy Gullihorn called Teenagers. He basically says, you know, if we're ever having trouble beating ourselves up enough, we've got teenagers to help us. And and then he says, sometimes the only thing that brings us through is the realization that someday our teenagers will grow up.
Right. And have
teenagers. You know, that's love. We're all difficult sometimes, but that's where, you know, the high lofty theory has to be worked out with your neighbor.
I so love that you've got this, you know, this global spiritual sort of movement has to begin here and now and in the present and with me and with my family and with my neighbors, not only those people who I live, you know, across from and beside, but those I interact with every single day, the people I'm shaking hands with. I love this, that it's that they're both connected, you know, the micro and the macro.
That's right. And I believe that with all of my being. And that outward, the macro, the micro, is also connected with the internal of even learning how to know and understand and rightly love myself. And in some way, this to me is kind of the doorway. You know, I'm 62 years old in a couple of days. And what I would say at this point in my life, I would say those experiences of love on all of those levels, that is the doorway to whatever we mean when we say the word God. That's the doorway into it.
Nice. Brian, thanks a lot for your time. I mean, yeah, wow. Thank you for the great spiritual migration, for what you're doing. Been talking to Brian McLaren today about his newish book, The Great Spiritual Migration, How the World's Largest Religion is Seeking a Better Way to Be Christian. Yeah, thanks for your time. I mean, you know, erring on the side of grace, generosity, and gratitude, and that's kind of how I feel when I read your work. By the way,
well, that's encouraging to hear. Always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.